This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. Dramatic new developments in the Derek Chauvin murder trial today. The medical examiner who conducted George Floyd's autopsy says he stands by his ruling that it was a homicide. He did acknowledge a key theory put forward by the defense that Floyd's drug use and heart problems played a role, but said they were not the direct cause. Just before the medical examiner took the stand, the prosecution called on yet another forensic expert to testify that neither drugs nor health problems caused Floyd's death. And we're also standing by for public remarks from the embattled Congressman Matt Gaetz, the Florida Republican, scheduled to speak tonight as the House Ethics Committee has now formally opened an investigation into his alleged conduct. But let's get right to our senior national correspondent, Sarah Seidner. She's covering the Chauvin trial for us in Minneapolis today. Sarah, we heard very important testimony today from the medical examiner who conducted George Floyd's autopsy.
This is definitely one of the most important witnesses because he's the only person that's going to testify that he was actually the one who did the autopsy on George Floyd, and he was unequivocal in what he said, how George Floyd died, why George Floyd died, no matter whether the prosecution or defense was asking him the questions.
One of the most important witnesses in this case for both the prosecution and defense took the stand today.
You conducted the autopsy on Mr. George Floyd.
I did.
Unlike all the other medical experts, Hennepin County Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Andrew Baker is the only person to testify that he did an autopsy on George Floyd's body. He determined the cause and manner of death.
The law enforcement subdual restraint and the neck compression was just more than Mr. Floyd could take.
But Prosecutor Jerry Blackwell asked if drugs or Floyd's heart disease caused Floyd's death.
Mr. Floyd's use of fentanyl did not cause the subdual or neck restraint. His heart disease did not cause the subdual or the neck restraint.
Without those two things, done by Derek Chauvin and the other officers, Mr. Floyd would not have died, he testified. But the defense tried to poke holes in his determinations.
And so in your opinion, both the heart disease as well as the history of hypertension and the drugs that were in his system played a role in Mr. Floyd's death?
In my opinion, yes.
Also on the stand,
the state will call for their first witness, Dr. Lindsay Thomas.
Veteran forensic pathologist Lindsay Thomas is unequivocal in her assessment of how George Floyd died.
There's no evidence to suggest he would have died that night, except for the interactions with law enforcement.
She agreed with Dr. Baker's autopsy report that Floyd's heart was enlarged and that he had drugs in his system. So Chauvin's attorney then asked a hypothetical question.
You find a person at home, no struggle with the police, right? The person doesn't have a heart problem, but you find fentanyl and methamphetamine in this person's system at the levels that they are at. Would you certify this as an overdose?
Again, in the absence of any of these other realities, yes, I could consider that to be an overdose.
But on redirect, she testified, that is not how George Floyd died.
The cause of death was the law enforcement subdual restraint and compression, and the manner of death is homicide.
Restraint and compression, restraint and compression, restraint and compression. We heard that over and over and over again from both of these medical experts. And that is the difficulty for the defense. No matter which way he tried to get around that and tried to ask whether it could have been drugs, whether it could have been his heart disease, in the end, they both went back to the same exact sentence. It was because of restraint and compression that George Floyd died. both.
Sarah, I want you to stick around. I also want to bring in our legal analyst, Elliot Williams, the criminal defense attorney, Mark O'Mara, and the chief medical examiner for Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, Dr. Carl Williams. Elliot, the medical examiner, we heard the testimony. It was very powerful, very dramatic, said the police officer's actions were more than Mr. Floyd could take. So how high stakes was this testimony today?
Right. Look, Wolf, there are three words that matter in this trial, right? And the legal standard is substantial causal factor. Were the actions of the police a substantial causal factor in George Floyd's death? And the simple fact is no one is disputing, and the prosecutors aren't disputing, of the presence of methamphetamine or fentanyl or anything in George Floyd's systems. But number one, looking at the medical examiner's report and all of the testimony, it is clear, and Dr. Thomas's testimony today as well confirmed, that the actions of the police were a, if not the, substantial causal factor in George Floyd's death. So even assuming the presence of the other substances or the size of his heart or whatever, strip that all away and get back down to what the law says. And it is just hard to see how the prosecution has not met this burden. Stranger things have happened before in trials, but it's just hard to see how they haven't won on that point.
Let me bring Dr. Williams into this. The medical examiner, Dr. Williams, and you're also a medical examiner, said heart disease and drugs played a role in Mr. Floyd's death. But he also said those issues weren't the direct cause of death. This was a homicide. As an expert in this area, what stood out to you?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that it's a homicide, and I think it's pretty clear that any medical examiner or coroner faced with this set of facts is going to call it a homicide. The only potential out, you have limited choices, is to leave it as quote-unquote undetermined, but the facts are so clear in this case that I don't think anybody would choose that option for the manner of death. The cause of death is more complex. You've heard some discussion of that. There's more ability to tell a story, and that's what you're trying to do when you certify the cause of death. You're trying to summarize all of the facts and tell a story, and different medical examiners, different coroners are going to choose a variety of different ways of putting that in the first part of the death certificate, the cause of death. And I think Dr. Baker did a very good job of putting that together, again, with the most important thing being the neck, the pressure on the neck. The neck is an extraordinarily vulnerable area. We all know that, and the police know that, and everybody knows that. I think that needed to be on the first line of the cause of death. And then the second part of the death certificate, which you've heard discussed as other significant conditions. Yeah. Again, you look through the facts, you look through what you have, you analyze all parts of the case, and then you choose what to put in the other significant conditions. And clearly, the presence that there was fentanyl on board, clearly the presence that he had heart disease, are other significant conditions that contributed to the death, with the primary cause always being the pressure on the neck, you know, in the context of police restraint.
You know, let me bring Mark into this because the prosecution, Mark, as you well know, doesn't need to prove that Chauvin's actions were the only factor in Mr. Floyd's death, just that they were, and Elliot pointed this out, a substantial causal factor in his death. So how does that testimony fit those parameters?
Well, Wolf, you know, a good team, legal defense team, legal prosecution team, spends about two-thirds of their time proving their case, and you try and spend about a third of your time disproving the other side. In this case, they've had the luxury with all of these witnesses, with all of the evidence, and they've done a very good job. They spent half their time, if not more, of dissecting and doing away with and literally destroying what the defense is going to argue, because the defense is going to argue exactly what Elliot said. It is not a significant contributing factor. So if so, then they have to come up with something else. The contributing factors, fentanyl, meth, heart, anything else other than Chauvin. And what the state has done, I think just wonderfully on their behalf, was prove their case without question, but also dismantle the defense case. And I don't know what the defense is going to be able to present. Certainly they're going to have their own experts to counter some of these experts, but the jury has been so massaged with all this information, it's going to be difficult to overcome.
You know, Sarah, you're there on the scene for us. This was clearly a very sensitive day talking about the autopsy. Can you just explain a little more how this was handled in court, how the jurors seemed to be reacting?
They were paying attention. They weren't writing as many notes as people have seen in the past with these medical experts. However, we are hearing that we are getting very close potentially to the prosecution wrapping up its case. As you might imagine, Dr. Baker, who is the chief medical examiner here in Hennepin County, was one of their linchpin witnesses. And now that he is done and he is, you know, finished with his testimony and the cross has happened, we may only have one more, for example, witness for the prosecution. So we could be hearing the defense's case very, very soon. And, you know, as our guest just mentioned, as our medical examiner just mentioned there, you know, they're going to probably put on experts who refute the experts that you have heard throughout this trial for the prosecution. But there are so many experts and their expertise world known in some cases that it is going to be an uphill battle.
Earlier today, Elliot, the forensic pathologist broke down a complicated phrase from the autopsy. She said, and she's an expert, it means, and I'm quoting now, she said, it means the activities of the law, excuse me, it means the activities of the law enforcement officers resulted in Mr. Floyd's death. But the medical examiner never really said it clearly. How important is it for the prosecution to simplify that for the jurors?
Right. Well, if you notice, what the prosecution did was put on two experts before they called the medical examiners. Just a quick word, Wolf. Experts are on to testify as to their opinions. They're people who don't have a direct connection to the case, but they're testifying based on their training and experience, right? Now, you could make an argument that the medical examiner who worked on the case is a more important witness. What I think the prosecution did was try to blunt the testimony of the medical examiner because there was some ambiguity and the defense does have some, for instance, the ME's report doesn't say the word asphyxia in it, and that's something that the defense could exploit. So what the prosecution did was put a couple witnesses on, very credible opinion witnesses, to frame things up and put things in plain terms. Okay, what's asphyxia? What were Mr. Floyd's final moments like? Get that on the record and then put the doctor who was, quite technical and didn't really stray from his technical views, his technical findings on the medical exam report, which was a clever way to put things on. Because had that medical examiner, Dr. Baker, testified earlier in the trial, I think this would have come out and felt very different, almost as a narrative matter. So you do kind of have to hand it to the creativity of the prosecution, because this isn't a foregone conclusion. Like, the order that you put witnesses on is itself a decision made by lawyers, and that's how the prosecution chose to do it.
You know, Mark, what's the most important thing, based on what has happened so far in these first 2 weeks, what's the most important thing the defense will need to do when they start to call their witnesses and make their case likely next week?
They have to come up with an alternative theory of death. The only way that they're going to get away from the strength of the state's case right now, as strong as it is and well-founded as it is, with not only the emotions of the first few days, but most importantly, the almost irrefutable testimony of all the experts. The only way the defense has a chance, and again, they don't have to prove innocence. They have to disprove reasonable doubt. The only way they're going to get to that standard is if they have some compelling evidence to say everything that the state witnesses said could be true, but it's not necessarily true. And here's an alternative. Here is a reasonable hypothesis of innocence, as we call it, of a way this could have happened. And if someone is strong on fentanyl and meth, strong on the heart disease with the combination of the drugs, if some good witness can come up and really wedge in that reasonable doubt, that's the defense's chance, and I think it's their only chance.
Do we have any idea, Sarah, how many witnesses the defense intends to call?
No, we do have a list of witnesses, but the list is just the 400 potential witnesses here. We do not think that all 400 will be called, but we will see. And we're not even exactly sure whether or not the prosecution is actually going to only call one more witness. But so we're just kind of waiting to see. We are all kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. And we know that each day, out of courtesy, the prosecution said they do tell the defense who is coming up. Each night before, and then the defense, who is already prepared, certainly, will know who they need to cross-examine each day, the night before that witness takes the stand. It has been fascinating. I do want to add one more thing, and we, you know, had to think of this at a larger scale, that really what the defense has to do is convince just one juror. That juror has some reasonable doubt, because then that would be a hung jury and they would have to either retry this case or decide not to, whatever the prosecution decides to do. So I'm sure that he plans on trying to do at least that.
Yeah, Wolf? I'm sure you're right. All right, guys, thank you very, very much. Coming up, there's more news we're following. We're standing by for public remarks from the embattled Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, as a new report finds he paid hundreds of dollars to an accused sex trafficker who then paid three young women that exact same amount. Also ahead, experts warn the U.S. is falling behind in the race against dangerous new coronavirus variants. We have new information. We'll share it with you. Stand by. The House Ethics Committee has just announced it's launching a formal investigation into the embattled Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz. The news comes just hours before Gaetz is supposed to give a highly anticipated speech down at the Doral Trump Hotel in Florida. Let's go to the scene. CNN's Randy Kaye has the very latest.
Congressman Matt Gaetz will take the stage under a cloud of suspicion, which has even some members of his own party calling for him to resign. Why does Rep. Adam Kinzinger think he should go? The accusations are stacking up. The Daily Beast now reporting that Gaetz sent two late-night Venmo transactions in May 2018 for $900 to his friend Joel Greenberg, a former Seminole County, Florida tax collector and accused sex offender. The next morning, according to the outlet, in an eight-minute span, Greenberg used the same app to send three young women money, totaling the same amount.
And what we have are Venmo payments that show payments from the congressman to this local official, and then hours later, payments that add up to the same exact amount to three young women, one of whom later turned out to be a porn star. And all of these women are extremely young.
Extremely young meaning what?
Well, one just turned 18 about 6 months before that happened.
CNN hasn't independently confirmed this report or what the money was used for. From the start, Gaetz has denied doing anything wrong.
It is a horrible allegation, and it is a lie.
A source also telling CNN federal investigators are looking into a trip Gaetz took to the Bahamas and whether women were paid to travel for sex with the congressman and others. That is a potential federal crime. CBS News, which first reported on the trip to the Bahamas, was told by a spokeswoman, Representative Gaetz has never paid for sex, nor has he had sex with an underage girl. What began with blaring headlines about sex trafficking has now turned into a general fishing exercise about vacations and consensual relationships with adults. It's unclear what Greenberg may know, but he and Gaetz were good friends.
He's uniquely situated.
Greenberg's lawyer now signaling that he is willing to make a plea deal with investigators.
Does he have anything to worry about? And you're asking me to get into the mind of Matt Gaetz. I'm sure Matt Gaetz is not feeling very comfortable today.
And there's more. Separate from the allegations of sex crimes, the New York Times is also reporting investigators have been told of a conversation where Gaetz and a prominent Florida lobbyist discussed arranging a so-called sham candidate in a state Senate race last year to siphon votes from an ally's opponent. They cautioned that aspect of the inquiry was in its early stages. Gaetz did not respond to the Times' request for comment on the allegations. All of this starting to hit closer to home for the congressman in an unavoidable way. A liberal political action committee has put up this billboard in the Florida Panhandle, which reads, Matt Gaetz wants to date your child. And Wolf, a bit more detail on that House Ethics Committee investigation. They've actually launched two investigations, one into Congressman Matt Gaetz, the other into Congressman Tom Reed of New York, potentially looking at Matt Gaetz for engaging in sexual misconduct, illicit drug use, converting campaign funds to personal use, and possible acceptance of a bribe. As far as Tom Reed goes, they're looking at allegations of sexual misconduct. Now, Gaetz's office did respond to this latest House Ethics Committee investigation, saying that once again, these allegations are blatantly false. They have not been validated by a single human being willing to put their name behind them. So we'll see if Matt Gaetz, when he takes the stage here at the Save America Summit here in Doral, Florida at 7 p.m. tonight, we'll see if he addresses that and anything else, Wolf.
We'll stay in touch with you, clearly. Thanks very much, Randy. We're joined now by CNN political director David Chalian, along with our senior political correspondent and the Inside Politics Sunday anchor, Abby Phillip. David, how do you expect Gaetz will try to navigate this scandal and this new investigation from the House Ethics Committee when he speaks publicly later tonight?
Well, I'm not sure if he'll address this publicly or maybe wear it as a badge of honor. I think if you've seen his responses to date, Wolf, he sort of is pulling from the Trump playbook of dealing with controversy and scandal. Obviously, he's denying everything, but he is also blaming his political opponents, blaming the media for this and taking zero responsibility or acknowledging any involvement in this. Of course, Matt Gaetz has something far bigger to worry about than his sort of PR problem here and how to navigate this. This is a potential huge legal problem for Matt Gaetz. That's really what he's focused on.
As you know, Abby, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois is now calling for Gaetz to resign from Congress. But so far, he's the lone congressional Republican calling for this, I take it. Hundreds of others remain silent, right?
Yeah, I mean, the silence is deafening on the Republican side. And to David's point, this is straight out of this kind of new era in crisis management led by Trump, which is effectively never back down, never apologize, never give in, even when the allegations are very serious. There was a time not that long ago when no one in Washington would have wanted to be near Matt Gaetz with a 10-foot pole. But of course, now he's speaking at that conference tonight in Doral, which tells you, I think, everything that you need to know about how much or how little people are distancing themselves from him. I think that there's actually probably more concern on the Republican side about abandoning him, perhaps too soon, before all of these allegations really play themselves out.
You know, David, the former Republican House Speaker John Boehner is exploring this growing rift in the Republican Party, and he's discussing it in a new book that is just out. I want you to listen to what he told CBS about one of his fellow Republicans. Listen to this.
You call some of these members political terrorists.
Oh, yeah. Jim Jordan especially. My colleague from Ohio. I just never saw a guy who spent more time tearing things apart and never building anything, never putting anything together.
So where does this go from here, David?
Well, as you noted, it is a rift inside the party, but John Boehner is on the losing side of that rift, Wolf. I mean, Donald Trump is gathering the Trump Republican Party this weekend in Florida, the event tonight that Gaetz is speaking at, Marjorie Taylor Greene speaking there, that's for sort of activists, part of a group that organized the January 6th rally, actually. You also have high dollar donors going to Mar-a-Lago to hear the former president this weekend. And you have a lot of 2024 Republican presidential hopefuls, should Donald Trump not run, showing up there as well to rub elbows with these high dollar donors. So Donald Trump has a pretty firm grip 100 days out of his presidency, or nearing that, on the Republican Party still. And John Boehner is making very wise observations about what occurred here. But make no mistake about it, his wing of the party is the one that is not ascendant inside the party right now.
David Chalian, Abby Phillip, guys, thanks very much. An important note to our viewers, be sure to join Abby for CNN's Inside Politics Sunday. It airs 8 a.m. Eastern. It's an excellent, excellent show. We'll be watching. Up next, experts warn the U.S. is falling behind in the race against the new coronavirus variants as cases and hospitalizations continue to rise. We're seeing some concerning new trends in the coronavirus pandemic, even as the pace of vaccinations here in the United States steadily climbs. CNN's Alexandra Field is tracking the late-breaking developments for us. Alexandra, we're getting some good news about Pfizer's vaccine. What are you hearing?
Yeah, a critical step forward in the push to vaccinate more people. Pfizer has applied to the FDA to allow for use of its vaccine among children ages 12 to 15. That after the company released data of a clinical study showing it's 100% effective in that age group. Now the acting chairman of an FDA vaccine advisory committee is saying it's highly likely that the FDA would give approval and that it could happen fairly quickly.
We're working to put this pandemic behind us as fast as we can.
But the spread of new COVID-19 cases is also yet again moving quickly.
The vaccine's great, but if these numbers skyrocket, that vaccine is not going to bail us out.
Nearly 80,000 new infections reported across the country on Thursday.
A year in, we all know what works, and this has to be a team effort. We have to do this together. Lives depend on it.
The governor of Michigan urging high schools to go remote as her state faces among the highest number of new cases per capita in the nation. Part of a surge in the upper Midwest where some cases are tied to youth sports and the prevalence of more transmissible variants.
We will be offering the states with significant increases in cases a set of additional tools to help them to stem the spread.
In part, that means making sure every distributed dose of a vaccine is administered. One quarter of American adults are now fully vaccinated.
Our vaccination efforts this week have continued to accelerate.
The White House task force saying there is enough supply to maintain the current average of about 3 million daily shots in arms. That despite a Johnson & Johnson manufacturing setback that's slowing their output and worrying governors already depending on those shipments.
We were told 2 days ago that we were going to have an 85% cut in the doses of J&J, which is about an 80,000 dose reduction for us.
Still, health experts predict we could soon be at the point where supply outpaces demand.
As more and more Americans gain access to the vaccine, I'm happy to share that vaccine confidence is rising.
There are, however, some concerns over the AstraZeneca vaccine, which isn't available in the U.S. Several vaccine advisors to the federal government now saying they wouldn't take the AstraZeneca vaccine themselves if given another option. Dr. Anthony Fauci says he doesn't foresee a need for the AstraZeneca vaccine in the U.S. But officials insist more does need to be done to combat vaccine hesitancy in order to get to herd immunity.
Millions of people still have questions about the vaccine. And misinformation and disinformation continues to spread.
Amid a handful of reports of breakthrough infections, illnesses, and deaths among elderly people who are fully vaccinated, Fauci responding by saying that, in very small numbers, is expected.
There's nothing there yet that's a red flag. We're obviously going to keep an eye out on that very, very carefully. But I don't see anything that changes our concept of the vaccine and its efficacy.
All right, you heard Dr. Fauci there saying no red flags. These breakthrough infections remain rare, but Fauci says the federal government is tracking any reported cases of them. The Surgeon General going on to say that confidence in these vaccines is high and that they are effective. Wolf?
Alexandra Field in New York, thanks very much. Let's get some analysis from CNN medical analyst Dr. Lena Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen, thanks as usual for joining us. You heard nearly 80,000 cases of coronavirus were reported in the U.S. just yesterday. That's higher, by the way, than we saw at the peak in July. And yet it seems warnings from public health officials, at least in many parts of the country, are being ignored. If we're basing public health behavior off of data, just how careful do we all need to be right now?
We should be careful because I do believe that we are in the middle of a fourth surge. The surge looks different from previous surges because we do have many of the most vulnerable who are already vaccinated and are already protected. But it's now younger people who are getting hospitalized, who are getting severely ill. And I think we have to keep in mind that we have a more transmissible variant. And that means that if we were able to get away with some activities before and to not get infected before, if there's something that's more contagious, we might get infected now. And so if you're not yet vaccinated, sign up and get vaccinated as soon as you can, if you're able to. And otherwise, continue to keep on masking, continue to avoid indoor crowded gatherings for the time being.
Dr. Fauci, as you heard, he says breakthrough cases, that's when someone tests positive for coronavirus after being fully vaccinated. He says that's not necessarily surprising. Can you explain what that means?
Absolutely. The vaccines that we have are extremely effective at preventing infection, but they're not 100%. There's nothing that's 100%. And so you are still going to see some infections that break through, even in people who are fully vaccinated. Some of those people may even become hospitalized or become severely ill, in large part because we do have some of the most vulnerable who have received the vaccine, who may already be very medically frail. So that's why it's really important for us to understand exactly what numbers we're talking about here. Very likely, the numbers that we're seeing are very, very low. We're talking about hundreds of breakthrough infections in hundreds of thousands of people in a particular area. But we need to see exactly what these cases are, what variants are involved, and also how severe are these cases. Because if it turns out that these breakthrough infections also tend to be less severe, that in itself would also give us even more confidence about the effectiveness of the vaccine in preventing severe infection.
I want to turn to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I know you, that's the single dose vaccine that you received. We're now learning that there may be some rare adverse reactions. Tell us what exactly is going on, because I know you've studied this very closely. Are you concerned at all?
So it appears now that there are four reported cases of blood clots and low platelets in people who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. However, I just want to emphasize this is not proven as a link. And actually, we don't even know the numbers of what we're talking about. As in, we know that when you give lots of vaccines to hundreds of millions of people, you are going to see naturally some health events occur. We need to understand what is the baseline level of these health events occurring compared to those who received the vaccine to really understand. A full investigation is absolutely needed. It needs to be done quickly and transparently. I will say that I myself, as you mentioned, Wolf, having taken the vaccine just over a week ago, I am not personally concerned because there is not yet evidence that links any of these adverse events to the vaccine.
Good point. Dr. Wen, thanks as usual for joining us. Coming up, sad news out of the United Kingdom. Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth, has died at the age of 99. We're going to London for an update. We're following important developments in Britain, where Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh and husband of Queen Elizabeth, died today. He was 99 years old. CNN's Bianca Nobilo is joining us from Windsor right now. Bianca, so how's the UK handling the news of Philip's death?
Well, Wolf, where I am right now, we're expecting more details about the funeral, namely the date, which people are waiting to hear. We expect to hear that tomorrow. And we do know that the funeral will be in line with customs and with the Duke of Edinburgh's wishes. But for tonight, a shocked and saddened nation remembers the legacy of an irreplaceable figurehead in British life.
Tonight, the end of an era in the royal family. Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, passing away today at the age of 99. The man who stood resolutely by the side of Queen Elizabeth II for more than 73 years now lies at Windsor Castle, draped in his personal standard. The announcement came just after midday, a simple note placed on the gates of Buckingham Palace in London, reading in part, "It is with deep sorrow that Her Majesty the Queen announces the death of her beloved husband. The Duke's body will remain at Windsor Castle, where members of the royal family will be able to come and pay their respects. The British Prime Minister among those paying tribute."
Like the expert carriage driver that he was, he helped to steer the royal family and the monarchy so that it remains an institution indisputably vital to the balance and happiness of our national life.
A somber silence at the royal family's two London residences, Windsor and Buckingham Palace, as crowds gathered.
He was a big symbol for a lot of people in England, and it's nice to pay our respects to him.
I have deep respect for the Queen. I love her. I think she's a wonderful woman, and I'm very sad for her today because she's lost her life partner.
His death, while a shock to the nation, was not unexpected. In March, the Duke left the hospital following a month's stay where he underwent heart surgery. He left in high spirits. Plans to celebrate his 100th birthday in June continued. Earlier in March, headlines would rock the royal family, involving allegations of racism.
Also, concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
But Prince Harry making it clear those racist sentiments were not delivered by Prince Philip or the Queen. Since marrying Queen Elizabeth in 1947, Prince Philip left an indelible mark on the many public figures he met, including a host of US presidents: Eisenhower, Ford, Kennedy, and Obama. President Biden, whom Philip never met personally, praised the Duke's decades of devoted public service, adding that his legacy will live on. As funeral arrangements are now being made, questions will inevitably turn to who will attend and whether his grandson, Prince Harry, will make that trip from California. For the next few days, flags will be lowered and a book of condolences opened. The nation mourns with Her Majesty the Queen at the loss of her beloved husband.
Funeral plans that have been many years in the making have now been drastically altered to comply with the UK's coronavirus restrictions. So where we'd expect thousands of people to attend and want to pay their respects on the day, only 30 will be able to attend the funeral. But as travel into the United Kingdom is permitted for compassionate grounds, including funerals, it is possible, Wolf, for Prince Harry to attend.
May he rest in peace and may his memory be a blessing. Bianca, thank you very much for that report. Coming up, the financial future of the powerful NRA gun lobby here in the United States is hanging in the balance as prosecutors accuse the group of abusing the bankruptcy process. And later, we'll have an update on all the late-breaking developments in the Derek Chauvin murder trial, everything that occurred today. Prosecutors are accusing the National Rifle Association of exploiting the bankruptcy process to sidestep its growing legal troubles. The powerful gun lobby is facing a lawsuit in New York for allegedly violating the state's charity laws and misusing funds. CNN's Bryn Gingras is working the story for us.
The financial future of the National Rifle Association may be decided in a Texas bankruptcy court. In a trial that kicked off this week, the NRA is hoping a judge will allow it to restructure, seeking Chapter 11, even after the country's largest gun lobbying group said just this January that it was, quote, in its strongest financial condition in years. It's one reason why prosecutors argue the NRA's bankruptcy request is just a ploy to escape legal troubles in New York, calling it in court
the masterclass in bad faith and dishonest conduct.
Back in August, New York Attorney General Letitia James sued the NRA.
We are seeking an order to dissolve the NRA in its entirety.
Accusing the organization, which is registered as a nonprofit in New York, of violating the state's charity laws. James singled out members of the NRA's leadership for misusing funds, particularly longtime CEO Wayne LaPierre.
Mr. LaPierre spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of the NRA's charitable assets for personal private plane trips for himself and his family.
The NRA claimed the suit was politically motivated and countersued. And in court this week, LaPierre said his use of NRA funds was necessary.
For security, as a security retreat.
Arguing he needed to take shelter on a friend's yacht after a string of mass shootings. Quote, I was basically under presidential threat without presidential security in terms of the number of threats I was getting. And this was the one place that I hope could feel safe, where I remember getting there going, thank God I'm safe, nobody can get me here. LaPierre's defense prompted gun control advocates to mock his notorious tagline.
To stop a bad guy with a gun, it takes a good guy with a gun.
One activist saying, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good friend with a yacht. The courtroom battling may end with a blow to the NRA, which is already facing a shift in support in the wake of more mass shootings.
Gun violence in this country is an epidemic.
And now a new administration calling for more action on gun control. A judge is expected to decide if the NRA can file for bankruptcy next week.
And Wolf, really, no matter which way the judge decides on this bankruptcy trial, the NRA could face more legal troubles down the line. As James said, she referred much of her findings to the IRS. Wolf?
Bryn Gingras reporting in New York. Thanks very much. Coming up, key developments in the Derek Chauvin murder trial today as the medical examiner who conducted George Floyd's autopsy stood by his conclusion that it was a homicide. And we're also waiting for public remarks from Congressman Matt Gaetz as he fends off a federal sex trafficking probe and a new House Ethics Committee investigation.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.